If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hi, I'm Matt, and I'm building forts out of cardboard boxes at the Filament Theater in Portage Park. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 797. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Of course, you could say hello to us online at all the outlets, the usual spots, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. That's it. I don't have a TikTok. There's no TikTok for the show. I'm looking around here. No, there's no TikTok. There's no Twitch. There's no Snapchat. I'm not even quite sure how all those work. And I sound like the oldest old man, but that's all right. OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com are the websites. I'm very much adept at websites. If you want to get the audio archives of the program, all now 16 years worth up at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and all the WGN shows on the WGN site. And download the podcast of the show if you don't do so already. We say good morning to our engineer in the studio today, Bob Ferguson, always making us sound wonderful on the air. And some possibly good news. This came out this week. The top doctor, Dr. Arwady, here in Chicago, says we have to keep wearing masks for a little while longer, but the Omicron peak has passed in Chicago, according to what we're hearing here, and the city is beginning to see its average new number of cases per day and positivity rate fall, which is always a good thing to hear in a pandemic, but it looks like we're going to be wearing masks for a little while longer. So look, whatever we need to do, right? We got to get these numbers down. We got to get these cases down. Last week, I was out with a friend of mine for this annual dinner that we do in the winter. You know, it's January. The weather's usually pretty cold in January, so we go inside to a nice steakhouse, and we've been doing this for years. And for the past couple of years, we haven't done it because of this COVID-19 pandemic. We went out to a steakhouse downtown, and everything was smooth. We walked in. They confirmed the reservation. They said, hey, can we check out your proof of vaccination? Had it on our phones. Showed that, showed an ID, good to go. And everyone to get in that restaurant, you had to have proof of vaccination. So it was a little bit, you know, in terms of making your mind at ease, I felt a little better. I was a little bit less stressed to be sitting in a restaurant with a lot of unmasked people because, you know, you're eating and drinking. But I realized that the wait staff at a crowded restaurant, sometimes the wait staff, they need to kind of get down to where you're sitting so you can hear them, they can hear you. And I never thought about that in normal times, but they get fairly close to you. Now, the wait staff was all masked, which was great, but this COVID pandemic now makes us think about just social interaction, how close we get to people. Are we breathing in their respiratory particles? What am I catching from this person just in a simple conversation? I never really thought about that before. But as I was sitting at that restaurant and the server was leaning over, telling me the specials, listening to me, I'm thinking to myself, wow, if this person was not masked, who knows what I'd be possibly catching here? I never thought like that before. That's how one way I think this pandemic has changed the way maybe we're going to interact socially. So there's that. But hey, at least we get to go out again and enjoy nice dinners and conversation. That's fun. We've got a great show for you today lined up. Stay tuned. We'll talk about the impact of traffic cameras in Chicago, who they are disproportionately impacting. Also, we'll talk about this rise of anti-Semitism in our society and some local music with Mark Vickery. He's behind the project known as Cosmic Bull. Stick around, maybe even make that reservation for a nice dinner out. Just saying. Everyone showing their proof of vax is a nice peace of mind. Those traffic cameras, the red light cameras and the speed cameras mounted on light poles throughout Chicago are the thorn in so many of our sides. The idea behind them is they help to reduce dangerous driving, and of course they generate tens of millions of dollars in fines for the city in the process. But who is overall being negatively impacted by these cameras? Well, a new report out by ProPublica says that these red light cameras disproportionately impact Black and Latino motorists. Emily Hopkins is a reporting fellow for ProPublica and is one of the authors of the report called Chicago's Race Neutral Traffic Cameras Ticket Black and Latino Drivers the Most. You could check out ProPublica.org for this report. Emily is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are very welcome. So we all know about these red light cameras. Most of us don't like them. There are hundreds of these cameras all over the city of Chicago. Just at the outset here, give us a sense of how these cameras are impacting these communities of color the most. What's the data telling us?
Sure. So I'll know that it's the red light cameras, which of course have been around since 2003, but we're also talking about speed cameras, which were introduced in 2013. What we're seeing is that, even though these cameras are spread roughly evenly throughout the city, households in majority Black and majority Hispanic neighborhoods are being ticketed at a higher rate than those in white neighborhoods. So we're seeing a racial disparity in the number of tickets that are given out. And then we're also obviously seeing that roll into what the financial consequences of the ticketing program is, which is very quickly after you get a ticket, if you don't pay it on a timely fashion, it will double your fees associated with that. And this is part of the larger fines and fees infrastructure that leads so many low-income people in Chicago to file for bankruptcy, get their car booted, all these kinds of financial outcomes.
Yeah. So I guess the next question here is, look, if we're saying that these cameras are all over the city and they're distributed fairly evenly, then why are these neighborhoods of color, primarily bearing the brunt of this? Why do you think this is happening?
Yeah, so we talked to many experts to try and understand what might be going on. And what we were told is that the actual infrastructure of the road has a huge impact on how people drive. And so when you put a camera on a road, for example, that is four lanes, no median, no crosswalk light, just a really, long, straight, wide open space, that's going to give a person the idea that they can go faster without, maybe they don't even know it, or if they are intentionally trying to speed, they'll go faster down that road because it feels like you can do that safely, even if it's not safe, mm-hmm. versus the kinds of neighborhoods. I mean, we've driven through on both types of these roads. I'm assuming you've driven in Chicago. The other type is like, you've got like the pedestrian median, you've got all the paint on and all these pedestrians, you've got all these kinds of things that signal to you to slow down, because you're not trying to crash your car. So those are the types of things, density, proximity to freeways, these kinds of infrastructural elements near the cameras is what's driving how much they ticket, essentially.
So part of this here, and you do get into this in your report, it's almost like the physicality of a neighborhood, the way that these streets, these roads are laid out, and you mentioned that maybe there's a median on some of these streets, which is going to make you slow down a little bit. And so how these neighborhoods are laid out actually makes a difference, as well as population density. And so what we're saying here is that then this doesn't bode well for these communities of color, because are we seeing these more just sort of straightaway roads, not a lot of population?
Yeah, I think, you know, generally we're seeing communities of color, low income communities of color, are living in places that have a history of disinvestment, whereas other parts, wealthier and whiter parts of Chicago, have a history of investments. You're seeing improvements to the roads, you're seeing density there, and we are, you know, positing that that is what's driving some of the disparities. And I think it's important to point out that, you know, we looked at the CAMRA program specifically, and obviously that has a financial burden associated with that. But the same things that are making or allowing drivers to make unsafe choices on these roadways are the things that actually hurt literal people, like, as well. You know, if you don't have pedestrian infrastructure, if you don't have things that slow drivers down, or if drivers aren't stopping at those stoplights, that's when the crashes happen, and that's when people tragically lose their lives on Chicago's roads. So those things are happening to Black and Latino Chicagoans at a disproportionate rate, the same way the ticketing program is disproportionately impacting the wallets of those families.
Let's pick up on that safety issue here, because whenever we talk about traffic cameras or red light cameras or speed cameras, you know, there's this issue of safety that always comes up, and I think part of the line from the city is, well, this is a safety issue, and I know that there has been research done on this. So when it comes to these traffic cameras and safety, I mean, is that a legitimate argument for keeping them around?
You know, I think that is the argument that the city is making, and I think many safety advocates are making the same argument. But I think this is the first time that we're really looking at the financial impact of this particular program and the degree of that, like how serious that impact is. I think it's going to be an evolving conversation, what is worth what. But what everyone agrees on, from the city to safety advocates to fines and fees reform advocates, everyone agrees that the way to prevent traffic fatalities is to fix the underlying infrastructure. Of course, that takes time and it takes money, and putting a camera up is something is the opposite. It's very fast solution and actually generates money. So I think that's sort of like the rock and the hard place that we're stuck between. And I think it'll be an ongoing conversation as time goes on.
You know, this traffic camera program has expanded over every mayoral administration for the last 20 years. And I think that when politicians talk about this, I mean, it's sometimes easy to say, you know what, we're going to put up more cameras, we're going to reduce the amount of crashes, we're going to increase safety. But I mean, we can't, at least in my mind, I can't turn my head away to the fact that there are tens of millions of dollars that are coming in here. And the city's probably, you know, not saying, well, you know, if it comes to not getting that, that's okay. They're probably welcoming that. So there is this, in addition to the financial impact and the burden on these communities of color especially, there's also the waterfall of revenue coming in for the city from these cameras.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's something that's been discussed, I think, since the beginning of the program, is that it's undeniable that this puts millions of dollars into the city's coffers every year. So, you know, it's difficult to turn that faucet off. Now, you know, that being said, that the city is very, you know, very adamant that this is about safety, and that this is that the idea of a fine and fee punishment to a motorist who breaks the law is an effective way to change behavior. And so, you know, that's the line that they are sticking with.
Yeah. You know, I didn't know this, but you do put this in your report up at ProPublica.org, that other cities, other municipalities across the country have actually discontinued some of these camera programs because, in part, of the controversy of how these programs have been impacting these minority communities. And I did not know that, but other cities across the country, some fairly big cities too, have discontinued this.
Yeah, we saw that this concern was raised in a handful of other cities, and some of them did discontinue their programs. And I want to also mention that, speaking of other cities, is that a lot of other cities are now turning towards this technology as a solution to tense traffic stops, sometimes dangerous or deadly traffic stops by police. And there, some cities are turning to this technology and saying, well, if we can remove the human police officer from this interaction, but still enforce traffic laws, it's a win-win. So I think what our report showed is it's not automatically a win-win, that this doesn't necessarily, solve every problem that they're trying to solve in that way.
And speaking of the politicians and policy here, Mayor Lightfoot, you do mention that even though this camera program has expanded, again, under her administration, she has made good on some promises to reform when it comes to this issue of ticketing and getting these fines, because that has been so punitive, especially for minority communities in Chicago. So she has been doing that, but at the same time, also expanding this camera program.
Yeah, absolutely. To her credit, she's made introduced some debt forgiveness programs, reduced the level of the fine for low income Chicagoans that will go into effect, we're told, by the end of March. And certainly these types of programs will lead to some people having that financial pain alleviated. But you're totally right. She did also expand the program. And the effect of that was that, there were tens of thousands, if not more, of tickets issued in 2021 that would not have otherwise been issued if that change had not gone into place. She's certainly delivered on some of those promises to alleviate the financial burden that these fines and fees can have on people.
So bottom line, the cameras, these traffic cameras across Chicago, they're probably not going anywhere. And really, when we look at this, maybe we should start thinking about the infrastructure of these Black and Latino communities when it comes to safety, if we really want to get at the heart of the issue here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think that this is something that Safer Streets advocates have said for years, is that they want safer infrastructure. They want investments in that infrastructure. And the city has made some commitments to, in their Vision Zero planning, plans to install and improve crosswalks and sidewalks across the city, as well as install some signs that are supposed to signal to the driver to slow down before you get hit by the camera. So there are some things, definitely on the table infrastructure wise that could be coming our way that might alleviate some of this stuff. But what everyone we talked to agreed, and again, including the city, that it's the infrastructure that is the ultimate solution.
Check out this report up at ProPublica.org. Again, it's called Chicago's Race Neutral Traffic Cameras Ticket Black and Latino Drivers the Most. Emily Hopkins is a reporting fellow at ProPublica and the co-author of this report. Emily, thank you for all of your reporting, all of your hard work, and we'll talk to you soon. Appreciate the time.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
The recent hostage situation at the Congregation Beth Israel Synagogue in Texas raises questions about the safety of Jewish people in this country. It's also a reminder of the scourge of anti-Semitism that exists in our society. Jews make up about 0.2% of the world's population, but every year in Western countries, Jews are the number one target of anti-religious hate crimes. With us to talk about this issue and what's being done to combat anti-Semitism is Rabbi Michael Siegel. He is the senior rabbi at the Anshe Emet Synagogue in Lakeview. Rabbi Siegel, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thank you so much, Mike, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, it's nice to talk to you. And so, look, I want to start with the context of this most recent situation in Texas. This hostage situation, it's been reported on in the news earlier this week, and that's been a week now. How did this hostage situation in Texas, just you personally, how did this affect you?
Well, I'll tell you, I heard the news on Saturday, and I walked back to the synagogue for a bar mitzvah service that we were holding that afternoon. And as I walked back to the synagogue, I'm looking at it from the outside, and I'm wondering to myself, do we have enough security? And what I was also wondering was, is there a priest or an imam in this area that's asking themselves similar questions? Because we at Anshayamet and most synagogues that I know of spend a lot of time thinking about security, thinking about emergency plans. The rabbi in Texas was saved because they had an emergency plan in case there was a hostage situation. And for Jews in America today, this is becoming more and more of a reality, that we actually have to think about whether going to synagogue is an act of courage, as Deborah Lipstadt wrote of recently.
You know, I think, first of all, maybe some of us are hearing that and are shocked, and because we don't, you know, a lot of us don't have to think like that. So it's important, I think, to hear this perspective. And many of us probably don't know that rabbis have received security training. You mentioned what happened in Texas and there was a security plan in place. I think most of us probably don't know that rabbis have had to go through this kind of training. But this is the reality that we're in right now.
That is true. And if I could just add to that, the reality is that most Jews will be reticent to enter a synagogue that doesn't have visible security. Now, that's a remarkable thing. We at Anshayamet have a great deal of security, and it's visible. Mm-hmm. We have never received a complaint from anyone saying, gosh, you have too much security here. It doesn't feel safe to walk in. I don't think they would walk in if they didn't see the security. And so that's just an indication, a small indication, of the world in which we live.
And what we're talking about here, sort of at the root of all this, is this anti-Semitism that is unfortunately alive and well in our society. And, you know, we hear about the violence, we hear about the attacks, and those are awful, and we don't like those, clearly. But this runs deeper. I mean, that's sort of the manifestation of this. I'd like to try to get to the core of why this exists. I know this is a difficult subject, a difficult topic to sort of explain why this exists, but I think, you know, we see this happen, and look, this is happening now. I don't want to say it's a regular event, but it's happening with some frequency here, and that's very scary. When we talk about anti-Semitism, what do you think drives this kind of hatred in our society?
Well, that's a large question, but I'll do my best to focus on a couple of different aspects. Anti-Semitism is been called, I think rightly, the world's oldest hatred. Mm-hmm. It is something that has pervaded the world's culture for thousands of years. And one of the driving forces of anti-Semitism is that the Jewish people are considered to be other. They observe their own laws of their own dietary laws, and they have their Sabbath. We have our Sabbath, where we may be different than the rest of society. And there is a bit of xenophobia there. But there are religious issues. Christian anti-Semitism has ramped up some of the issues. Jews have been seen as being remarkably, almost supernaturally powerful. Mm-hmm. Jews have been blamed for the Black Death. Jews have been blamed for the crucifixion of Jesus. Which is, by the way, a form of deicide. And so this is a hatred that has flowed through history through a number of different tributaries. And it is present in America as well. And some people believe that there has been a hiatus in visible forms of anti-Semitism in response to the Holocaust, the greatest anti-Semitic act in Jewish history, where one-third of our people were murdered for the crime of being a Jew. And perhaps people didn't feel as though they could express themselves or express their feelings about Jews, if you will, or their anti-Semitic approach. But time has passed. People have a short memory when it comes to history in general, and I think the history of the Jewish people in particular. And I think that that's become more and more evident. But I will also add, Mike, that the internet and hatred and false opinions and all kinds of hatreds have been expressed and have been supercharged on the internet and on sites like Facebook or Instagram or you name or Twitter, and without a check on truth. And I think that has simply raised and raised and raised the specter of anti-Semitism to a point where in a recent study, one in every four Jews in this country have experienced anti-Semitism. Almost 40% of the American Jewish community has said that they have changed their behavior in some way because of the rising anti-Semitism. So that should tell you a little bit about where we're going. And it's not slowing down. And that is very concerning.
This is concerning. And, you know, I just, what you said about the internet right there and some of those social media platforms, you know, we talk about conspiracy theories that are being broadcast and transmitted throughout these different platforms. But, you know, when we talk about these sort of old tropes about Jewish people, you see a lot of those conspiracy theories that somehow Jewish people are in control of certain sectors of society, which is, I mean, patently false.
Yes.
But I mean, I feel like these sort of conspiratorial theories are being fed to people, and that is promoting some of this as well.
There's no question about it. And as false as they are, they carry on. The Jews have all of the money. Jews control Hollywood. Jews control the internet. And these kinds of supernatural powers that Jews are, that people attribute to Jews, are really remarkably dangerous. And what it does is it creates a sense that Jews, because they're powerful, or they're seen as being powerful, that their concerns don't count. Well, Jews are all wealthy. What if this happened in a synagogue? And David Baddiel has written a book recently. He's a comedian in England. And he wrote a book that's very serious, basically saying Jews don't count. The same kinds of concerns for hatred racism that people acknowledge and focus on when it comes to people of color, when it comes to other groups around the world, that courtesy is not afforded to the Jewish people. It's as if Jews don't count in this conversation. Well, Jews are different. Jews are other. And I think that is very concerning.
In a way, I mean, do you see it as almost like a dehumanization? I mean, you're taking away, it seems like this whole notion takes away the fact that Jewish people are human beings with needs and wants and feelings just like any other human being. It's almost like we're taking away that humanity and saying, well, you know, because they are the other, the rules don't apply necessarily to them.
Well, I think that, you know, Shakespeare in The Merchant of Venice spoke almost those same words. Don't Jews feel? Don't Jews hurt? Of course they do. Of course they're human. And the fact that we would even have this conversation speaks volumes about the times in which we live. Are we so other that people actually have to prove that Jews are human? And the other thing, Mike, that we need to add to this conversation is the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Israel has been criticized, and rightly at times, for some of its policies, just like any nation in the world should be criticized. But the extent to which Israel is critiqued, the number of criticisms that have come from the United Nations, right? Far greater than countries like North Korea, far greater than Iran. The Jews are being, and this also is ramping up, you know, anti-Semitism. How could a Jewish person support a country that is accused falsely of being colonial, that's being accused falsely of being an apartheid state, that's being accused of racism falsely in Israel? That's not to suggest that Israel doesn't have things that it needs to work on, right? But no other country in the world becomes delegitimized, that where people say maybe it will be better for the state of Israel not to exist. What I was going to say was the United States has a long and ugly history to acknowledge, but no one is saying that the United States is not a legitimate country. But those kinds of issues are not that kind of thinking isn't afforded to the state of Israel, and that also adds to the anti-Semitism. So you'll find anti-Semitism on the right, where Jews are too powerful. You have anti-Semitism on the left in progressive circles, that if you support the state of Israel, then you must be a racist. You have anti-Semitism in some religious circles, whether in the Muslim circles, in some Muslim circles, and in some Christian circles. But I want to also underscore that where America is different, Mike, is that America, the United States, does not have a governmental history of anti-Semitism. It doesn't have that kind of history. And the government and the people of America, by overwhelming numbers, are supportive of the Jewish people. See what happened the day after that horrible hostage situation. There was a church meeting where the Muslim community, the Christian community came out. Thousands of people came out to support the Jewish people. The same thing happened after the massacre in Pittsburgh. And so I don't want to focus on the negative alone. I think it is a small group that's being amplified in social media, but I think it's concerning, obviously. The gauntlet has been laid down, and we need to be concerned. We need to protect ourselves, but I also think we need to be talking to one another, sharing with one another, and expressing our concerns with one another, so that, you know, our voices count, our feelings count, and that as much as any other group that is concerned about their safety.
And that leads into one of the last things I'd like to ask you, and that is, you know, what can we do to stop this anti-Semitism? How can we combat it? And you started to talk about, you know, having more of a dialogue and togetherness, but, you know, let's talk about what's being done and locally here in Chicago. How are we fighting this? How should we fight this?
Well, I think that fight against anti-Semitism is the same as any fight of any form of racism. You have to name it, right? Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitic jokes aren't funny. Racist jokes aren't funny. And when people spew all kinds of crazy ideas about the Jewish people, then people have to be willing to call it out. They have to be willing to acknowledge it, just as we would hope and expect that people would do when they hear racist comments or hear words that are used in derogatory ways. We have to make this a priority, because this does, and Jewish history teaches us over and over again. It may start with the Jews, but it never ends with the Jews. Hatred and this kind of these expressions of hatred affect other groups as well. And so for the good of the country, we need to speak out against racism. We also need to speak with a loud voice against anti-Semitism. The Jewish people are not as secure as some would suggest. We don't run the country. We don't own the world. There's not a cabal of rabbis out there controlling the universe. But those ideas are out there, and they need to be called out and acknowledged for the hateful rhetoric that it represents.
Yeah, I think naming this is incredibly important. Calling this out, I think you're absolutely right with that. And in Chicago, in the community, in the faith community, and even, you know, beyond in the secular community, is that happening? Is that a conscious thing that people are aware of and doing around here?
Well, I want to say that the Chicago Police Department has been exemplary. On Saturday, when all this was going on, the police department reached out, the commander reached out, wanted to make sure that we had what we needed, made sure that there were cars, that there was a police presence in front of synagogues, that the issues were heightened in their eyes. I think the mayor's office has been exemplary. I also want to acknowledge my pastors and priests in the Christian tradition, imams in the Muslim tradition that have reached out. So I think there's a better story to tell. There's a lot to be concerned about, but let's also embrace and celebrate the best of America too, that has been expressed again and again and again. Because I know that I am not only a proud American, I'm a proud Jew, but I embrace the promise of America. And I believe that we can do better, but we're only going to do better when we speak out, when we hear things that shouldn't be said, or our erroneous opinions are simply expressions of hate.
Rabbi, I've enjoyed talking to you, but I'm kind of sad that we have to have this conversation, that, you know, this is a thing. Yeah. I mean, but we really do need to name it, to call it out, and come together for the promise of a better tomorrow. I mean, it might sound cliche, but I think once you hear what's going on and hear a perspective from someone like yourself, this might open some eyes and change some hearts. So I really hope that's the case. Rabbi Michael Siegel is the senior rabbi at the Anshe Emet Synagogue in Lakeview. Rabbi Siegel, it's been a pleasure to talk with you again. Hopefully we can do it again under some maybe more cheery circumstances. But thank you for your time, and best of luck going forward.
Thank you, Mike. And I do appreciate this opportunity to have such a thoughtful conversation. Thanks for making it possible.
Vickery, the man behind the project Cosmic Bowl, is here with us today on Outside the Loop, you know, providing us some local tunes, always appreciated. Mark, welcome to the show. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. So you are no stranger to the Chicago music scene. You have been playing with bands. I mean, I don't want to, like, you know, make you sound like an old guy here, but you've been doing this for decades now in Chicago. What a time we're in currently, huh? This is like unlike anything we've ever seen.
To be honest with you, that's kind of exactly why I felt the kind of the impetus to come out with new music now. It's literally been 20 years since I've released anything. That really, literally 20 years. People say that figuratively.
Yeah.
It's not that I haven't been playing. I have been. It's just that what was my purpose, you know? And so now I think I've found it as an older guy. The EP that I'm coming out with is, by the way, called 27 by 2, because I'm 54. So I'm basically saying that I've lived the life of two dead rock stars.
27 by 2.
27 by 2. And but that's not just that, not just the fact that I'm older and have a different perspective on stuff, which I think is valid, though, because now I'm not just talking about being in my early 20s and being a moron and, you know, trying to hook up with girls or whatever. But like everything else on the radio is still like that. It's always been like that. But there's another aspect to it. There's another way you can come at it. And I found that, and especially in these crazy times now that we're in, I feel like a sense of duty toward kind of representing that to a certain extent. If that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think that artists now, and I've talked to other musicians during this pandemic era that we're living in, and, you know, what they say is, boy, the stuff that's going to come out of here. I mean, it stinks that we're in a pandemic, but maybe kind of a different creative opportunity when we're all forced to be at home more often than we perhaps would like. But facing that and maybe going introspective a little bit, who knows what's going to come out of this artistically?
Oh, I imagine a ton of stuff. Yeah. And that's definitely no accident that this is coming out now. There's also a different project I won't talk about on this show, but other than to say my old college band got back together through wave files from San Francisco to Chicago to New Jersey. Mm-hmm. We haven't been together for 35 years and now we're doing new music too, just because we're all at home. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, I mean, look, this is an amazing time in terms of that. Like, we can all sort of collaborate artistically from a distance. But what you've done here, you've got this EP that's coming out called 27 by 2. And the project, again, is Cosmic Bull.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what this project's all about.
Now, Cosmic Bull has had a few singles actually come out. Like over the summer, just figuring out how to do the streaming thing and getting it released among friends and acquaintances and some a little bit further than that, not much further. This is the first body of work that I wanted to kind of have as a song cycle where it has a narrative that kind of threads through it, even though the songs are written independently. So it's not a strict narrative. It's not a rock opera or anything, but it's something that kind of, to me, it kind of followed a trajectory and it ultimately was to, again, going back to kind of justifying the presence of a 54-year-old guy coming out with new music who's not already like famous from before.
Right. Well, the single is called Joe Namath Moment. And tell us about this, because like you were saying, I mean, there is a little bit of a story behind each of these songs. Tell us about Joe Namath Moment.
Yeah. Also, anybody who has a working knowledge of sports history in America will know that the actual Joe Namath Moment is that great Super Bowl championship where he was supposed to get killed by whoever, the Colts, and he came out and bragged about how he's going to win. He channeled his inner Muhammad Ali and actually wound up winning the game. This huge, heroic Broadway Joe was born, all this kind of amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. This Joe Namath Moment, however, is about, again, we're talking about from a middle-aged guy's point of view. Flash forward 30 years from that Super Bowl, and he was on the sidelines at Monday Night Football, and anybody, most people are going to probably know he kind of made an ass of himself on the sidelines and live TV with, like, I don't know how many millions of people watching him drunk on the sidelines saying to this woman over and over, he wants to kiss her. So everybody knows, even people that don't know football that well or don't regularly watch Monday Night Football, I imagine have some understanding of the Joe Namath Moment that I'm referring to.
Oh yeah. Plenty of memes out there on this one.
And to be honest with you, I love Joe Namath. I don't want him to sue me over this. I think he's fantastic, and I think he's an absolute icon. My thinking is here, if it can happen to Joe Namath, it can happen to you. So it's kind of like one of those things where if you're the middle-aged guy at the club or at the bar or whatever, and you think you still got a little bit of mojo, especially with a couple extra 2-3 drinks in you, be warned. It may not work out the way you want it to, you know? So that's the idea behind the song.
It's a cautionary tale that we should all hear.
Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly, a cautionary tale.
With a face like yours, we can make a scene for the folks at home on that TV screen. Remember, you should know, I used to be Mr. So-and-so. Now you say, I ain't got no class. Happens to me nowadays, every time I make another pass.
Your music, specifically your vocals, I mean, I love, you know, just talking to you, you got that awesome voice. I mean, it's there, and I think it's really interesting when I listen to your music, because the vocals, I mean, it's very much in that lower range, which, you know, a lot of times with rock music and just music in general, those singers like just to get way up there, and that's not what you're doing. You're just kind of hanging out in that low register, and it works so well. I love that style.
Thanks. It's not really my choice. I would love to be able to wail over the top of a loud rock band. I just never be able to do it. I thought for years I wasn't able to sing at all. It's just that I was singing way out of my range. So I had 20 years to figure this out, Mike. So I had, like, sitting at home in my basement, just jamming on stuff. And if I just dropped it an octave, suddenly I can sing it, you know? So, I mean, that went for cover songs, and it went for stuff that I was working on. And pretty soon I just fitted in. It just became the thing, you know?
knowing yourself, right? I guess that's part of getting older. 27 by 2, here we are, right?
That's exactly it. You know, I mean, so that's what I mean. That's just one of many lessons that this EP has to teach the world at large.
So to tell, well, I love it. Tell us, I mean, looking forward here, who knows what's going to happen when we talk about live music, but do you have any plans, you know, for coming out there live, anything on the horizon that you can tell us about yet?
No, not really. Not concretely anyway. There's plenty of musicians I would love to work with in a live situation, but it's very touch and go with what places are even open or having shows or what. I mean, it's like, it's hard to really plan for that. And I'd like to be able to pay people that, you know, I hire to be in the band with me. So I'd hate to have all these, you know, get it like primed up and ready to go, and then there's no gigs.
Yeah. Right?
So I'm a little behind on that, I think, as opposed to having the music go out. But also, I think if people do listen to the tunes and like it, there may be some interest in having, you know, there might be a little bit of push. You know, maybe I'll be a little bit more inclined to actually put a band together because people are digging what they're hearing on the EP or on the single or because on the radio or whatever.
So we want to direct everyone to Facebook. You can search Facebook for Cosmic Bull, B-U-L-L. You've got a Facebook page. Also, there's some tunes up on SoundCloud if you search for Cosmic Bull. So you've got a presence there, but this new EP is called 27 by 2, and the release, I believe, is in March. Is that right?
The full EP will be coming out on March 4th, and the single Joe Namath Moment is going to drop on January 28th. So it gives a few weeks in between there, so people can get used to the single, get used to the sound, get used to how it's produced. I get used to my voice, probably, and all those things. So, and then if they're clamoring for more, then the EP will be on its way, and it's 6 songs long, so it's not a full LP, but.
All right. Well, it is the project called Cosmic Bull. The musician, the local musician behind that, Mark Vickery. Check him out on Facebook. Search for Cosmic Bull. Also on SoundCloud. And Mark, best of luck with everything. You keep doing what you're doing. It's okay that you're in that low register. You sound awesome. No need to wail. You keep doing your thing, man. And best of luck navigating this whole pandemic. And hopefully we get out there soon and we'll see you live.
Mike, really, thanks a lot for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Say hi to the folks at home, folks at home, folks at home. Say hi to the folks at home. Say hi to the folks at home. Say hi to the folks at home, folks at home, folks at home.
And that'll just about do it. Outside the Loop show number 797 is all done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I really do appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. Have a fantastic week. I'll talk to you again next time here on Outside the Loop.